All right, anyone else have anything to say about that? See if I can push through the rest of this lecture in the time that's left. I'd like to get into graph theory next time, so I'm going to see if I can finish off the growth rate stuff. All right, we good? You with me? Thank you. All right, I'm going to go for it. So here's where we left off. I started telling you about, and we just recap, this notion of growth rate. So things like how many syllables are in a song as a function of n, where n is the number of verses. What does that have to do with algorithms in computer science? Well, it turns out that you can analyze lots of things in that same way, where n ends up being the size of the input to the algorithm. So as a concrete example, I'm going to analyze the sock sorters that we talked about a couple times ago, where n now, instead of being the number of verses, it's going to be the number of pairs of socks. So how does the running time of each of these sorting algorithms that we're going to measure by how many times you reach into the basket, on average, as a function of the number of socks that you're trying to sort? Just to remind you, these different algorithms had different forms, and they ended up with different numbers of pulls out of the laundry basket. Sorter 1, the algorithm was grab two socks, see if they match. If they don't, put them back. The number of socks pulled out of the basket before all 50 socks? 100 socks? I forget. I think it was 50 pairs of socks. Was like 50-50. Sorter 2, you grab two socks. If they don't match, put one of them back and grab a new one until you actually find a mate for this first one. Once you do, then pair them up and you start over again. This algorithm ended up with about half the number of draws out of the basket than the first one. Sorter 3 was grab one sock and don't replace it until a match was found. I think what this one did is it grabbed a sock, it tried to see if it had a match. If it didn't match, the sock that didn't match was put aside, not back into the basket, but off onto a table. And everything was taken out of the basket one at a time until the match was found. Once the match was found, all these other socks were put back into the basket and the process repeated. And then sorter 4 said, essentially, you know, is it expensive to take things out of the basket? Just do it once. Dump out the entire basket onto the table and do all your matching on the table. And this took 100, yeah, so this is 100 socks or 50 pairs of socks. Okay. So there, you get different totals. Now, how do these totals actually relate to each other as far as trying to analyze them is concerned? So, let me see how much time I have to see what level of detail to go into. I mean, I think this is sort of interesting, but at the same time, it does get a little detailed in terms of the algebra if you want to do it right. But let me see if I can give you the flavor of this. And so we go. All right, so how many times do we have to do get sock when we run sorter one algorithm to sort 50 pairs of socks? Now remember, what we're doing is with sorter one, grab a sock, grab another sock. If they match, great. And now we've got fewer socks in the basket. If they don't match, put them both back and start again. So how many times do we, if we've got 50 pairs of socks in there, how many times do we do this random grabbing two socks and matching them before we find a pair? Well, it sort of depends on the probability with which two random socks will give us a pairing. Now I'm going to claim that the probability of reaching in and grabbing a pair of matching socks is 1 in 99, 1 out of 99. Why is that? Well, there's 100 socks in there. We grab one. There's 99 socks in there. How many of them match this one that we have in my hand? One. So there's one chance in 99 that second sock I grab will be the match for the first sock I grab. So each time we take out two socks, we have a 1 in 99 chance that it's a match. So how many times before we actually get a match? So this is very nice property. I don't know if you've seen this before, but it really works, and it's very simple, so you might as well remember it. If you have an event that has some probability P, the number of times you have to repeat that event before you get a positive outcome is 1 over P. So in other words, if something has a 1 in 99 chance of happening, on average, you have to do it 99 times before it'll actually happen. So the weatherman says, 1 in 10 chance that it's going to rain today. The number of times that the weatherman says that before it actually rains is going to be 10 on average, assuming weathermen do their job right. Okay. So how many times do I have to flip a coin before it comes up heads? Well, what's the probability of getting heads?
1 out of 2.
1 out of 2, a half, right? So on average, how many times before I get a head?
2.
2, right? I'm going to keep making babies until I get a girl. Let's say that it's a 1 in 2 chance of getting a girl. How many kids am I going to end up with on average?
2.
2. right? It doesn't mean that I'm always going to get a boy then a girl. That would be exactly two. In fact, that's the only way I can get exactly two. What it means is, if everybody's trying to do this, some of them are going to get a girl on the first try. Some of them are going to get a girl on the 10th try. On average, it's going to be two. Okay? So if it's 1 out of 99, and there's also, you can get to with the dreidel or something. So if something's 1 in 4, what else goes 1 in 4? Or a die. So you have a die, you know, like a six-sided die, and you roll it. How many times do I have to roll it before I get a 6? 6. On average, right? It's not always 6. But it averages out to 6. All right, so it's going to take us 99 pulls of socks out of the basket. 99 pairs of socks that we pull out of the basket before we get our first pair. So that means twice 99 pulls out of the basket, or 198, to get the very first pair on average. Now we've got one fewer pair in the basket. So we're going to keep repeating this, and each time it's going to be a little bit quicker before we find the pair. So if we've got n pairs of socks in the basket, the number on average of pulls that we have to do from the basket is 2 times 2n minus 1. This is the total number of socks minus the one in our hand, and we're pulling out socks in groups of 2. So this is an expression that says how many times it's going to take before we get one pair, 4n minus 2. Now there's n minus 1 pairs left. Finding the second pair is going to take the same expression except decremented by 1, 4n minus 6. We keep doing this. The total is actually going to be 4n minus 2 plus 4n minus 6 plus da-da-da-da all the way down to, when we just have 2 socks left, how many times do we have to pull before we get a pair? 2. So that's the total that we've got. It's actually, you can rewrite it as 4 times the sum of the numbers from 1 to n minus something else. And we've seen this before. We saw this last lecture. This sum, 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus all the way up to n, is roughly n squared. In fact, it's exactly n times n plus 2, n plus 1 divided by 2. So you work all this through, you get, in this case it ends up being very clean, you get 2 times n squared. That's the number of pulls out of the basket on average before we can get all the socks sorted. So this I would call, we can ignore the concept, we'll call this a quadratic algorithm. Intuitively, what does this have to do with the house that Jack built? That was also quadratic. What does this have to do with the running to the pylons? That was also quadratic. The answer is, if you think about the number of times we pull out of the basket, it starts off kind of like n, and then the next time it's kind of like n minus 1, and the next time it's kind of like n minus 2, and we go all the way down to 1. The sum of that is that triangle shape again. The running time is n squared. So sorter 1 was an n squared algorithm, specifically 2 times n squared. Sorter 2 is a slightly different algorithm, and in fact, it's very closely related to the first one. So what happens in sorter 2? In sorter 2, we grab one sock, and then we keep pulling from the basket until we find its mate. You can work through the same kind of analysis, and what we end up with, I don't think it will help anyone to get to see all the details here, but really what it ends up turning into is n squared plus 1. So whereas sorter 1 took like 2 times n squared, this one takes n squared plus 1. Which one is faster? If n is big, which one's going to take fewer times pulling out of the basket? 2n squared or n squared plus 1? 2n squared is a bigger number. That means it's slower. That means it's more times pulling out of the basket. Yeah. But if, you know, ignoring constants and so forth, this is still quadratic. This is another quadratic algorithm. This has a better constant. Sorter 3. So how does sorter 3 work? Grab one sock, then grab socks one at a time without replacement until its mate is found. So what we do is there's 100 socks in there right now, we grab one out, and then we just start going through the whole pile until we find the one that matches this one. On average, how many socks do we have to pull out before we find that guy's mate? So let's think about that for a second. So imagine all the socks, this is not really what's going on, but imagine all the socks laid out in a row. And there's one particular sock we want. There's how many socks? There's 99 socks lined up. How far down the row do we have to go before we find the one we want? What? Right, if there's 99 on the table, we more or less have to go through, like, do we always get lucky and it just takes a couple? Do we always get unlucky and it takes, we have to go all the way through the list? Where in the list on average are we going to find the red one.
Four and a half.
Yeah, like roughly near the middle? Is that what you're thinking? It makes some sense. So anything like this? So imagine. Yeah, I don't have any other good analogies. But just in general, the expected number of socks we have to check is going to be half the list, right? Because half the time we're going to take more than that, half the time we're going to take less. It turns out that it averages to the middle of the list. So we have to, and then once we find the right sock, we know we have the right sock, we can put everything back in the basket and start again. So on average, we're going to get 51 socks taken from the basket before the first pair is found. Right, there was 100 socks in the basket, we take one out, and then we have to run through basically 50 more before we find its mate, on average. So, if you start to work that out, you end up seeing that the first time through, actually it's easier to think about in the reverse order. The very last time, there's two socks left in the basket, right, because we're always going to take the fine pairs and decrease the total number of socks by two. So let's say there's two socks left in the basket. We're going to have to grab it, and then, of course, we'll find its mate. So there's two pulls out of the basket. The time before that, there's four socks in the basket. We're going to grab one, and on average, we're going to find the mate for it at this point. So there's going to be three pulls out of the basket. The time before that, we're going to take it four. The time before that, five, all the way up to n plus one. This total is the same as the sum of the numbers from 1 to n plus some other stuff. In other words, it's basically quadratic, and in fact, n squared over 2 plus some other stuff. So this is also a quadratic algorithm, n squared algorithm. The other stuff we're going to try to ignore, but basically the constant with the n squared is a half. So we had one algorithm that was like 2n squared, one algorithm that was like 1n squared, and this algorithm is like a half n squared. They're all n squared algorithms, so it would be better if we could find something smaller than n squared. But of the three of them, this one has the best running time. All right, and so the last algorithm was sorter 4. What sorter 4 does is it starts off and reaches into the basket, gets a sock, doesn't know what to do with it, puts it on the table. Reaches in, gets the second sock, looks on the table one at a time to see if there's a match for that sock. If there is, it makes the pair. If not, it adds it to the table. The total number of draws out of the basket is exactly the number of socks in the basket. So we always get, if we have n pairs of socks, there's 2n socks in the basket, and that's the number of socks that we actually pull out. So this is an O of n algorithm in terms of the number of pulls out of the basket. This is better, a lot better, as n gets big than any of the n squared algorithms. So this is how we use, well, usually we don't use it on socks per se, but this is how we use this growth order analysis to try to understand what's the better way of solving a problem when you've got multiple ways of solving a problem. We usually can't, I mean, it just turned out with these sock algorithms that all the analyses ended up being very exact. Like, I could actually give you, in the sorter 3 case, I could give you an exact expression for the average. This is usually very hard to do, but it's usually much easier to just come up with an n squared, like a big O representation. And so usually we just focus on that. If you can find an algorithm that's n squared, great. If you can find one that's better than that, even better. We don't worry about all the little details. All right, so what I'd like to do, I think I really can finish this off today, in the time remaining, is to talk a little bit about this notion of what does it mean to have one algorithm that's better than another? So we all know people from New York, right? Maybe some of us even are from New York. Whenever I get together with my cousins from New York, there's always, especially at the end of the party or the family event or whatever, they go into the discussion of how they're going to get home. Or equivalently, how are they going to get to some landmark like the airport? Oh, I would never take Route 287. Oh, are you kidding? You want to take Verrazano? I mean, they debate incredibly in detail the best way to get from point A to point B. And I think part of it is they just like to talk. But I think another part of it is there's different notions of what it means to be the best way to go. And so I was hoping to brainstorm a little bit about what is it we're trying to optimize when we're coming up with algorithms? A lot of time in computer algorithms, we're trying to optimize for time. We want to design an algorithm that will give us the answer that's right as quickly as possible. But it's not always that simple, right? We might be willing to wait a lot longer if we don't have to buy a new computer to do it because our current computer doesn't have enough memory. So memory sometimes matters. there's lots of things that could matter. But you're not computer architects, so maybe you don't think about that as much. But we should all be able to think about this. If we're trying to find the best way to go to the airport, what do we mean by best? What could we mean by best? So somebody might say, well, time. What's going to get me there the fastest? Another person might say, money. What's going to get me there with paying the smallest amount of tolls? Or maybe some combination of tolls and gas, right? Because now gas is fairly expensive. If you can find me a way to get there using as little gas as possible, that also is very valuable. What else? What else could matter? Any thoughts? Can anybody get to the airport?
Density of traffic, you know?
So you might want to minimize the traffic that you pass through, maybe because of risking an accident, or just not liking to be around people. I want to get there seeing as few people as possible. That's perfectly legitimate. Anybody else? Thoughts?
Time of day.
Hang on one second. Go ahead.
Oh, errands. Like, you need to do something else.
Oh, it could be that you want to get there, and it's not just local. It's not just getting there. It's getting there, but you also want to, say, you know, visit as many flower shops as possible because you're in the market for that. Time of day.
I prefer to go at 10 at night than 5 p.m.
But that wouldn't change what route you take, right? But it is something that you might want to be trying to think about. Yes. Yeah. Or maybe I will take whatever route is possible, but I don't want to be at the bridge at 5:20 p.m. because that's when everything's crazy. And so I might want to try to avoid that and find me a route, and it can go over the bridge, just not at that time. Try to minimize the number of possible law enforcement encounters. That's legitimate. Well, maybe not, actually.
Just the condition of the road to minimize
time. Oh, yeah, so the wear and tear on your car, for example, if you're driving. Driving's not the only way to go to the airport, right? You could also say, hey, I can minimize tolls by walking to the airport, right? Then you might say, well, you know, wear and tear on my sneakers or something like that. Any other thoughts? Anybody over here? You ever go to the airport? How did you choose how to go?
I don't remember.
I choose a path that makes me have to think about it the least, right? Because that can be a real thing. Imagine sometimes people give me directions and they say, okay, you can go the good way or you can go the easy way. And sometimes I'll just choose the easy way because there's like the probability of getting lost, there's the probability of forgetting the directions in the middle. Maybe you guys don't do that, but I know I do. Where am I even going? I don't know. I'm lost. Who am I? All right. So there's lots of things you might want to try to optimize for, and what algorithm design is about is once you've picked one of these things, say we're trying to minimize gas, let's find that route. Let's find the route that minimizes gas. Let's find the route that minimizes time spent. Okay. Mostly we talk about minimizing time, but that's not the only thing. And the fun of algorithm design, what makes it sort of a puzzly kind of thing, is that once somebody's picked what the rules of the game are, what it is we're trying to minimize, then you have to think really hard to figure out how you're going to achieve that. So it can be really fun. So let's see, I think I have a... So here's an example that I would like to do. I don't know. I don't know how this is going to go. I just thought of this, and that'd be fun. So let's say, and I don't know if this is true of everybody, but let's say that when you go to a restaurant, you eat out, you tip your server. You should tip your server. And let's say that you tip 15%. Now, I know when I go out with friends, they seem to want me to compute to 15%. And they think because I, you know, am familiar with computers that somehow I'm good at, like, arithmetic, which turns out to be false. But I am good at algorithm design, and so I finally came up with a way of computing the 15% tip that minimizes time and stuff that I write and interpretability by people watching so they don't realize I'm doing something really silly. But I can compute my 15%. So I want to show you my algorithm for computing tips. And if you've got your own algorithms, you can share them with me. I would like to hear them. But here's how it goes. So, I don't know, give me a total bill.
100.
Well, that would be easy, right?
Yeah.
This is how I compute my 15% tip. First, I figure out what to order on the menu so that it adds up to 100. Then I always tip exactly the same amount. That's an algorithm. It kind of doesn't optimize, say, your waste, because if you just wanted a cup of water, that's not a good way to do it.
One OT.
What's that?
One OT.
either you have expensive taste or you have a lot of friends, or possibly both. All right, so we want to compute a 15% tip on this amount. So I'll show you what I do, and then I'll explain to you how it actually gives the right answer. All right, so I go like this. $15.57, or rounded up to 58 cents. Okay, so does that look like a good algorithm? Should I tell you how this works? Or was that kind of obvious? I do this now all the time, so I can't tell if it's silly anymore. So here's what you do. So let me show you the algorithm, and then I'll explain why the algorithm works. And what I'm trying to minimize here is, like, writing, I guess, mostly. So first thing I do is take the number and divide it in half. And the way that I write that, since dividing by 2 is a fairly easy thing to do, you think of dividing by 2 going like this, right? You have the number underneath. I just flip it around. It turns out to be helpful to do that. All right, so for this algorithm. All right, so 2, so that's half of 10 is 5, half of 3 is 1, carry the 1, half of 18 is 9, half of 4 is 2. All right, so I've computed half of that. Now, I'm going to sum up. This is now an addition problem, these two numbers. So 6, 8 plus 9 is 7, carry the 1, 5, 5, 1, okay? Then I throw away the last digit. I probably should have never even computed it in the first place. And what's left is the 10. Okay? Why? Do you see why? All right, so if the amount is x, the first thing that we're computing is, so what are the steps? First, divide total in half. 2, add total. And step 1. 3, throw away the last digits. All right, so if our total initially is x, then half of our total is x over 2. The sum of these two things is what? Well, it sort of depends where the decimal point is. So let's say that this is actually, let's take it as 100 times x. All right, and so half of that is actually 50 times x. Right, 100 times x because I'm moving the decimal point over twice to do it in cents. All right, add those together, then I throw away the last digit. Oh, add those together, give us what? 150 times x. Then throwing away the last digit is like dividing by 10. So that's 15 times x. And actually, then we put the decimal point, I think that's step 4. Put in the decimal point. That's actually dividing it by 100, so then when we're done, we get 15% of x. Oh. So is there, do you have a better way to do it? You don't do this proof each time, right? Unless you're, you know, into that sort of thing. You really just do this.
It's a tip calculator.
So that's a different algorithm, if you have the right equipment. So this is ridiculous. Is that the consensus?
That's what I do.
This is what you do? Literally writing it this way too?
Well, I don't write anything, but I divide it by 10 first. That's it.
You don't write anything. So if you have no short-term, so the other thing is if you have good short-term memory, you just do this in your head and be done with it. If you're really good at multiplying, you just do it. But I actually have none of those things. So
so
this works for me.
And then divide the 10 by like
half.
So it's 5, and
then
I just add them together.
In your head.
Yeah.
Yeah, see? Imagine for a second that you have no short-term memory. This turns out to be great. But everybody's too smart, I guess. All right. If anybody ever tries this and finds it useful, send me an email, no matter how long in the future it is. The purpose here is to give you a sense of what it means to do an algorithm. When you learn to do long division and long multiplication, or whatever, multi-digit multiplication, you're taught algorithms, right? They don't give you the definition and ask you to prove the answer. They actually give you a series of steps. And the series of steps is specifically designed so that the amount of writing that you do is small. There's not a lot of crossing out. There's not a lot of extra pieces of paper that you have to fill with symbols. There's not a lot that you have to hold in your head. So all the arithmetic stuff that you learn, somebody came up with those algorithms. And they teach them to you as algorithms. Okay, anyway. All right, so what I'd like to do is, not that, what happened? So the slide creation program is really clever. It lets you paste web pages in, which is really neat, except that if you actually have to be online to have access to those web pages. And so if you're not online, it just shows you garbage. It's not technically garbage. Oh, come on. I'm logged in now.
Yeah, but it's probably cached.
But why? I don't want it to be cached. That should flush the cache. There it is. Woohoo! All right, so what I'm going to lead in with next time is graph algorithms. I've got 5 minutes now. I wanted to do a little bit of an aside. I was looking at the newspaper yesterday, and saw a picture of this guy, and I'm like, wait, I know this guy. His name's John Kleinberg. He's a computer science professor and very smart guy from Cornell. And let's see. So they had a little spiel on him, and it turns out that mainly what they talk about, they talk a little bit about algorithms, so I thought that was appropriate, and they talk a little bit about networks, and that's basically what graphs are. Graphs are representations of networks. So I thought you might find this interesting. So computer science is not only a comparatively young field, but also one that has to prove it really is a science. Newspaper people, they don't know anything. Skeptics in academia would often say that after Alan Turing described the concept of a universal machine in the late 30s, that a computer in theory could be made to do the work of any calculating machine, including the human brain, all that remained was mere engineering. I've never heard anyone say that. The more generous perspective today is that decades of stunningly rapid advances in processing speed, storage, and networking, along with development of increasingly clever software, have brought computing into science, business, and culture in ways that were barely imagined years ago. The quantitative changes delivered through smart engineering, not just smart engineering, it's good science, open the door to qualitative changes. Computing changes what can be seen, simulated, and done. So in science, computing makes it possible to simulate climate change and unravel the human genome. In business, low-cost computing, the internet, digital communications are transforming the global economy. In culture, the artifacts of computing include the iPod, YouTube, and computer animated movies. That's really all we've been trying to do all these years, culminate in iPod, YouTube, and computer animated movies. What's next? This was a subject of a symposium in Washington this month held by some people I never heard of, which is part of some other group I never heard of. But apparently they're the nation's leading advisory board on science and technology. The title of the symposium was 2016. You'd think they could have at least written it in binary. Computer scientists from academia and companies like IBM and Google discussed topics including social networks, which is a graph theory thing, digital imaging, online media, and the impact on work and employment. But most talks touched on two broad themes. Impact of computing, we'll go deeper into this. The impact of computing will go deeper into science and describe more in it. I can't parse that. But anyway, the policy issues will loom large, technology becomes more powerful, more pervasive. So, Karp, who's a very famous computer scientist and algorithm designer, gave a talk on the algorithmic nature of scientific theories. But his point here is a really neat point. He said, one of the reasons computing has had such an impact on other sciences is that, simply put, it comes down to what an algorithm is. An algorithm is a step-by-step recipe for calculating something, for getting something done. And each of those steps has to actually be implemented on something real. So this is the notion of reduction that I try to keep coming back to. That one of the things, the main thing we do in computer science is take some big complicated thing and break it up into smaller parts, and those smaller parts have to actually be real. Now this is different from, say, the way biology was done many years ago, where you could, to try to explain the heart, you just say, it's like a pump, and we know how pumps work, and so therefore we're done. You actually have to break it into sub-pieces, and those sub-pieces have to be real things, not just ideas. Right? So for us, it gets cached out into bits and bytes, and we can actually implement them and really run these things. So what algorithms do is give you that step-by-step breakdown. And algorithms are small but beautiful, Karp observed, and algorithms are good at describing dynamic processes, things that change over time, things that do stuff, while scientific formulas or equations are more suited to static phenomena, just describing how something is and not how it changes over time. Increasingly, scientific research seeks to understand dynamic processes. This happens in biology, this happens in psychology, this happens in art, this happens anytime that people are trying to understand process. Businesses think about how you get from point A to point B, and that's basically algorithmic study, even if it's done in other fields. And so what Karp is saying is that that's why computer science has been so useful to other people outside of computer science, because we're trying to figure out how to think about processes like that. And so he says biology is a great example of it. He says nature is computing. That's very nice. Alright, so what I'm going to start up with next time is, that is algorithms. The next section of this talks about social networks, and I want to tell you about the notation and concepts behind networking and graph theory, and I'll talk about Google to get you the idea. Okay.